You're listening to The Critical Point on aerogel.org. I'm your host, Steven Steiner. In this podcast, I sit down with Dr. Peter So from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Dr. So was the principal investigator for the Stardust probe. That was the spacecraft that successfully captured and returned comet dust to Earth for scientific analysis. The spacecraft also possessed a unique particle capture system comprised of tiles of silica aerogel. Just a heads up about the interview, it's about an hour long and the audio quality's not the best, but this is definitely a story you won't want to miss. Dr. So, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dr. So, why don't you start by giving us a little bit of background about yourself? Where were you born? What did you study in college? And what got you interested in aerogels?
Well, let me go reverse order that. That's more interesting. Why I got into interest in aerogel is a means to an end. I have a problem I have to solve. In order for me to realize a mission, which is to answer the question, where does life come from? Many scientists believe that when Earth is formed with the solar system somewhere 4.6 billion years ago, Earth was very hot. Probably water and life would not exist. Then the question is, as it cooled down, where does the water come from? It's not likely the water will come from within because it was very hot. In fact, the center of Earth now is a huge furnace. So the question is, many scientists believe, and for a good reason, comets, there are just huge number of comets orbiting about the sun, which we can't see because they're too far apart. Most of them have a lot of water, some 50%, some even 75% water. Well, that's certainly a possible source. It's a very reasonable hypothesis that the water come from early impacts. Earth was impacted very much like the moon, and a lot of them would be cometary impacts. So water could come from a comet. And the reason life also could perhaps come from a comet is that, well, we found comets, they do have a lot of organics. Some even found there's amino acids.
Wow.
The Murchison meteorite that was landed, in fact, if it wasn't for the Star Wars type of monitor system that the Reagan put it in, no one would believe it. Because there are many people say they find in the backyard, oh yeah, this is a piece of meteorite and it could sell for top dollars.
Right.
But typical before then, most people, scientists would feel that if it looks like a piece of coal, it's a piece of coal from some earth, around area. Murchison is very black, like a piece of coal. The reason scientists tend to put serious thought to it, this may come from the meteorite, really from outside. Because the Star Trek type of a system actually tracked the object, which landed in Australia, where near the town where it's called Murchison.
Wow, all the way from space to the ground.
Yes.
Wow.
They were able to trace it to say, okay, yes, in fact, it did come from outside, and told them where it was. So a piece of coal, you would not accuse it's a coal,
right,
from Earth coal, but rather from outside. And you then have amino acids come,
wow,
a lot of organics. Well, so the reason I was interested in the aerogel, that I was back in 81, I guess, and when I was working on a comet mission, I learned comet, yes, does potentially have answered some of this question, like water and life on Earth. But how do you answer the question? Probably no better way to get a piece of sample from there and take it back down to Earth to analyze. Because we cannot put any sophisticated instruments in a spacecraft and do analysis.
Right.
Not only you don't have the power, you don't have the mass, you don't have the person, the analyst come with it, a whole host of reasons. So it's much easier to bring a sample back to Earth and analyze it. But to do that, also, you're doing it at low cost. Low cost. Well, true, Stardust is $200 million. No one would say that's a low cost.
But in terms of NASA budget.
No, but even compare something. For example, the Titanic movie was shot about $200 million.
So we can have a movie or we can have a part of a comet.
Yeah. So, well, because that mission and to do it, I want to be able to do it in a reasonable time and a reasonable possibility we'll fund it. So it has to be low cost. Now, normal sample return, if I want to get a sample from on top of Himalayas, probably I have to climb up there, take a shovel, and come down. Well, if I do that with the comet, the cost will be billions of dollars.
Sure. Yeah.
Then the chances for such a mission, then accordingly, would be very, very
unlikely.
Yeah, unlikely. So I had to come up with a little more compromising, but at least I have a mission, right? It's a flyby mission. Flyby meaning I'm flying very fast by it. I don't land. But to do that, then the relative velocity with the spacecraft and the comet are very high, 10, 20 kilometers per second. 10, 20 kilometers per second.
That's fast.
Give you some idea, it's very fast. A Saturday night special is 200 meters per second. It's 0.2 kilometers per second.
0.2, wow.
We're talking about 10 or 20 kilometers.
Order of magnitude higher.
Yeah, much, much higher. Well, to catch a speeding bullet is very difficult to retain it, catch and retain the bullet, so you can do a meaningful analysis. It's almost impossible at that speed.
Well, but and these particles aren't the size of a bullet, but they're...
The speeds are high, but in order to analyze the particles, but you still, if it's all broken up, atomized, you lose a tremendous amount of
information. So you want to keep you want to catch the bullet and keep it intact.
Well, at least a portion of it intact.
You cannot
keep enough that we can do analysis. It's basically like space forensics. You know, you get a little paint chip, a little here, a little there, but then you can maybe. The sample is very small,
sure.
But you can have a pretty good idea of the whole thing. Okay, so to do that, however, at such a high speed, well, how am I supposed to catch speeding bullets? Aerogel comes in, and that's why I was involved in aerogel.
So you are a planetary scientist by training, then?
No. Well, actually, you know, I consider myself, since it's my background, yeah, I have a lot of engineering background, and taking a lot of different courses. Well, actually, when I got to JPL, then I realized this is a very fascinating area to answer questions that people can only dream about,
right.
and talk about it, but not really involved in trying to realize it. and so I consider myself really a problem solver. Here's a problem, here's a challenge. Well, find ways to do it. I'm not a chemist. This is sort of a chemical training background, or neither am I a planetary scientist in background, but I said, well, I'm just curious. I happen to be in the right organization at the right time, and for a while I made the best aerogel, not because I'm the best chemist, because I was really very focused to solve a problem.
Well, and they say curiosity is the ingredient which is most necessary for innovation.
That's very, very true. I'd like to add that not all innovations really come from a systematic plan procedure. There are many quote unquote accidents, and in many cases in Stardust mission and all that did that way. Well, anyway, so aerogel, it is important to use aerogel for several reasons. The particles I'm trying to collect from the comet are small. It is small.
How big are we talking?
I'm using a reference that we can fit in our hair. Well, some people have thicker hair than
yeah,
others.
Sure,
but roughly, hair is about 100 microns.
100 microns.
To me, the planetary scientist, a particle is 100 microns is very huge, very large.
So this is for the audience, if we were to take 10 of these particles and lay them end to end, it would be 1 millimeter.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that is true.
So something small, if you could see with your eye, but very tiny.
Yeah, very, very tiny. Well, now, such a small particle, it is important for us to analyze that we human beings, a visual person,
right.
You like to see it.
Right.
Well, the material which I use to prove I can stop a bullet and without breaking up, I've done that. But the material I use are polymer foams.
Okay.
Polymer foams are all opaque.
What kind of a polymer foam?
It's polystyrene.
Polystyrene, so like styrofoam.
It's the same raw material, but not like styrofoam. But a different formulation.
Different formulation.
Yeah. But the point is, if I can stop that, since it's opaque, I can't see it. Well, especially looking at such a small particle in an opaque form, it's very difficult. True, you can use X-ray to locate it, but once you locate it, then you're physically trying to get it.
Trying to find your car keys in a snowbank.
Yeah, but your car key is white.
That's right.
So now the issue is the reason aerogel comes in there, the polymer forms are opaque, but aerogel is transparent.
Oh, I see. So
a very small particle.
Transparency of aerogel.
Yeah, but it turns out as I get into more and more, when I prepare for the mission, aerogel solves several other important critical issues too. One, for example, out in space, you know, the reason people ages, you know, your cloth, you know, plastic get brittle and all, is UV. It's ubiquitous and very strong because you don't have the Earth atmosphere to filter.
No ozone layer.
Yeah, there's no ozone umbrella.
That's right.
to shield it. So as a result, most plastics on Earth will just disintegrate in space. If you put a styrofoam, a white, you know, you buy a computer, white styrofoam,
sure.
You put it on a yard, let the sun, maybe a couple of weeks, it turn a brown, light brown powder.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. But then in space, since UV is much stronger, it probably takes no time for it to temporarily disintegrate. Now, if I use that kind of polymer material, it disintegrates before it comes back. I don't have anything.
Right.
I don't know what. So I got to have a material that is UV resistant.
So we've got transparency and we have radiation resistance.
Yes. Well, a third aspect is in space. It's unlike on Earth because of the Earth atmosphere. And the light is shining. It's bright from all different directions. But in space, since there's no reflection, molecular reflection of sunlight, you look at the sun, it's hot.
Right.
Very hot. Like noonday hot. And you're hotter when you go in space without the atmosphere ameliorated.
Ultra hot on one side and ultra cold
yeah.
in the shadow, right?
When you're not looking at the sun, it's very, very cold. You know, it's minus 200 some odd degrees C in some
right.
temperature. So as a result, such a big, when you're in space, you tend to turn. So whatever object it is, hot and cold, this cycling, it does havoc to organic material.
I see. Tremendous thermal gradients.
It's thermocycling.
Cycling.
Yeah, because the cycling, it causes fissure, cracks, and all that damage. Yeah, I don't want my whatever collected materials all disintegrate before that.
Right.
So there's another one. Well, you see, I'm accumulating that more and more I need a very esoteric material. Aerogel happened to be very esoteric, and it fills it. Then we do know that when the particle, any particle, a bullet goes very, very fast, at high speed, then whatever the first comes to impact, it sends a shock pressure, a shock to the particle, as well as to the captured material, of course. But the shock causes a lot of damage. We do know this initial shock, it's proportional to the density. So the lower the density, the better it will be. Well, if the material is monolithic, the same density, your low density, then it's be very long.
Monolithic.
I probably need meters long of this low density material.
Right.
Well, in space, weight and volume, it's equally expensive.
That's right.
So as a result, that I cannot afford to have several meters long of collecting material. So I got to have it short. In fact, on Stardust, it's only 3 centimeters thick.
3 centimeters thick. So that's the depth of the collector.
Of the collector. So I have to be very clever. So I have to make a material that, in fact, the aerogel on top for the particle impact, it's the lowest density possible and increased by many folds. And I attempted to make such a material, maybe a minimum 5-to-1 or 10-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
So this way,
10 times more dense at the bottom than it is at the top.
Yes. In a sense, I'm reducing the length of it, but by a factor of 10 or more.
Oh, that's very cool. but keeping in mind, and for the audience to keep in mind that an aerogel, which is, an aerogel which is 10 times denser than another aerogel is still extremely light.
Oh, yeah, yes.
And Dr. Tsu has just pulled out a sample of this gradient, this density gradient aerogel, and I'm holding it, and it's absolutely fascinating. Of course, all aerogels tend to be. So which way is the gradient going?
This is the lower, this is the higher.
Okay, and you can actually see slightly that it's a change in how hazy the material is along the density gradient.
Yes. Well, so it is important for me to have a material that has the capability to have such density variation without radically changing the structure of the material. Because you need a certain structure, mesostructure, or the structure material to be able to softly capture a high-speed bullet. Now, so I don't know of a material, in fact, you can change the density by a factor of 10 without changing the structure.
Right, so you can't do that with styrofoam very easily.
No, you can't. You can't. Well, most liquids tend to have a density, it's about 1, a little less than 1 or more than 1.
1 gram per cubic centimeter.
Yes. But you couldn't change its structure and with different density. So anyway, so aerogel happened to film all those factors. Now, one more factor. Now, in space,
So our 3 factors now are the radiation resistance and the ability to change its density.
And ability density, right. Another very important factor that is because it's very low mass. Now, in space, before a spacecraft is launched, you argue about a very tiny bit of mass, 1/10 of a gram, and you want to minimize because it is a premium to put weight up because typically, in order for a spacecraft to launch and leave the gravity of Earth, it's roughly 100 to 1. If you lift 1 pound, you need 100 pounds. Well, 1 gram—that's 100 grams.
Yeah, in terms of cost, it's something like to send a pound of material into space is something like $10,000.
Well, it depends what it is. It could be considerable more than that.
Sure.
Okay. So the issue that this aerogel, see, anything you put on a spacecraft, you are meticulous to know its mass, or we call it weight, but
sure.
How much it weighs. Now, this is the first time on a spacecraft when I use aerogel, there's no account for its mass. Because everyone recognized it's very low mass. It's so light, there's no point to keep track of it. This is probably the first one that we fly this, any kind of flying material on the spacecraft.
And you didn't have
There's
to
no account for the mass. So having a low mass is very, very valuable as well.
So the 4 properties being transparency, radiation resistance, the ability to change its density in the formulation, and the fact that it's very lightweight, all made aerogel the perfect material for your application.
Yes.
So that's one thing that is so unique about these materials is that they bring together all these extraordinary properties at the same time.
Yes.
So
and let me just say as one thing, one would think I could come up with a story. Yes, I knew what I was looking for, so I designed it. I invented this material just to fill that. That's not the case. It's not. It happened by accident. I was looking for a material that would be able to useful for I would call it the right mesostructure material that has the density I'm looking for. And I was looking everywhere. It turns out Los Alamos National Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Well, not Albuquerque, it's Los Alamos.
Outside
Albuquerque. I was looking there. That was the laboratory for a while. They were looking for very exotic material kinds. I believe for some classified reasons.
Sure, which can't talk about it on the program.
If they tell you they had to kill me or something like that. I was looking for, just looking. They really supplied me some very esoteric material that it really captures material hypervelocity very well. In fact, I could capture a piece of aluminum ball at 6 kilometers, and you couldn't even tell it was launched.
Wow.
Yeah, hardly any loss.
Zip, stuck in there, stuck in the material.
Yeah. If you know, aluminum is a very soft material.
Mm-hmm.
It's at 6 kilometers, I retain that. So I found a way to do it. But it's a polymer foam. So I was looking even better foam, but I happened to be in somebody's laboratory and talking about foam, mostly polymer foams, you know, various formulation, composition, and all this. And I happened to see on the windowsill, in a container, something that's transparent. At that time, I realized I was looking for something transparent, but I almost give up because no polymer chemistry, none of the foam can be made into transparent. And say, well, even if I give $1 million, they won't guarantee that we'll come up with it. So I didn't have $1 million, sure. So I'm sort of not going to ask them to do that. Then I saw something that is, hey, this looks like it's almost translucent transparent. I said, what is that material? It says, oh, yeah, there's something we did, you know, years ago. We don't use it anymore. I said, what is the material? He was, you know, forget it. Don't even talk about it. That's not used to it.
Right.
I said, wait a minute. I'm using it. And he told me that's aerogel.
Aerogel.
That's the first time I heard the term aerogel. I said, well, by the sound, it says air and gel. But that is neither gel
or
nor
air.
So what is the aerogel? Then he said, well, we used to make that for our purpose. And then we decided a long time ago that it would not work. So we don't make it anymore. I said, who makes it? It turns out their sister research institution is Lawrence Livermore.
That's right.
Both run by UC Berkeley. I think left over from the atomic bomb days.
That's right.
Man project days. I said, well, they still make them. Wow, give me the name. Wow. No time, I rushed over there and talked with them. And they were making aerosol. So I immediately grabbed, tested, because at that time I realized, you see, also another reason the aerosol is very useful. In order for me to simulate all the development work, I had to use a special gun. I can shoot 6 kilometers, 6-10 kilometers per second.
So simulating microparticle.
Yeah, so I know this material, it works or doesn't work, or how well it works, why it doesn't work. Well, to have such a gun, and JPL does not have such a gun, it's actually, you know, to have such a gun, you got to be a little more careful, you know, a little more. Well, most handguns, or even high-speed rifle, it's considered single-stage gun. So the gunpowder or whatever powder, explosives, the explosives pushes on the projectile.
Uh-huh.
That's considered a
single-stage gun.
The fastest it will go is really about 2 kilometers per second.
And you need at least 3 times that.
Yeah. So someone a long time ago devised a method to find out, hey, the so-called two-stage gun.
Okay.
The two-stage gun is that the first stage, the gun doesn't push on the projectile. The gun compresses on a gas,
okay,
a light gas, like helium, hydrogen. Hydrogen works better.
Okay.
If you compress hydrogen to a certain pressure point, it will burst a diaphragm. That diaphragm burst is very high speed, much faster than gunpowder burns. So that bursting of this light gas, or hydrogen, pushes on the projectile.
Oh wow! So that's
a two-stage.
Push on a diaphragm until it pops, and then that pressure wave pushes the projectile.
Yes. So this way you can go beyond 2 kilometers per second. It reaches about 7, 8. Some people claim 9.
Okay.
I haven't found a gun that does
that.
But So I had to use a facility which is elsewhere. I'm in Pasadena, California, and that gun happened to be in close to San Francisco and Mountain View, California. Well, can you imagine if I have to do an experiment and that facility costs about $2,000 per shot.
Per shot?
Yes. Then, more important, they can only do 2 or 3 shots a day. Well, if you do an experiment, you do a shot, I cannot see because of opaque material. I don't know whether I have done satisfy my hypothesis or didn't, I don't know. I have to take one shot, go home, analyze 3 months later, and decide what to do. I have wasted the whole day. I have two more shots I could do. I couldn't.
That's right.
So from a very practical reason, I need to capture material. I can shoot. I can quickly determine which direction the next experiment I should do.
Sure.
if it's opaque, I will keep on shooting without even knowing what the results, you know. That's very dumb.
So this is where the transparency becomes important.
Yes. So more than just capturing, even for me as an experimenter, is very important. See, if very opaque, my cycle per shot is at least 3-4 months, and that's very, very long.
Long development time.
I got to pay for the travel from Los Angeles to Mountain View for every shot.
Every shot.
So there's an additional reason that aerogel is very unique from the experimental development point of view. It's very helpful.
It made it possible to iterate. Well, so that's fascinating. So I'm interested now in understanding your role in the chemistry of this. So you said you're not a chemist by training, but as I understand it, you actually did quite a bit of the actual lab work, formulations, getting your hands dirty on the aerogel.
At the time when I found Livermore was able to make the
material. Who was it at Livermore that you interfaced with, by the way?
Larry Rubish.
Larry Rubish.
Yes. he is very helpful, but an interesting story.
Uh-huh.
It turns out at the time I went to Livermore, he gave me some aerogel. Most aerogel they were making is 100 milligrams per cc, which is a tenth of the density of water.
Sure.
Velocity is one. I tried that. Wow. That aerogel, although it's only a tenth the density of water, or our human being naturally is mostly water, so density is 1,
sure.
A tenth of that. But that aerogel is very hard. If you knock it on your head, you can hear it. You're
mimicking
it.
<That's> right.
It's very hard. It's like a brick.
Yes.
Already. Well, I take that aerogel, I try to shoot. Yes, I can see it, but I saw it broke out of projectile totally.
Wow.
So I said, wow.
Even
transparency is fantastic, but
it's too hard. So that's fascinating to think that something that's still 98% air, 99% air, you know, even though it's a tenth of a gram per cubic centimeter, when you're going that fast, is actually quite hard.
Yes. Yeah. Well, anyway, so I told Larry, I said, well, the transparency, I still like it. Because I can tell the experiment failed, but the projectiles are broken up. But I would like to have much lower density. And of course, I don't have any money, you know, but I just interested in that, you know. So how low do you want it? Oh, as low as possible.
Uh-huh.
You know, density of air is 0.0013, which is, I would tend to milligrams, is 1.3 milligrams per cc. Well, 1.6, that's very low.
That's very low.
In fact, their application, they need probably higher density. That's what they're making. They have no intention, no desire to make lower one. And in order for me to fund National Laboratory in Livermore,
right,
I probably have a truckloads of money,
right.
Which I don't have. But unbeknownst to me, in about a few months, he gave me a piece of aerogel. That's 50 milligrams.
Oh, wow.
In a few months later, it's 20 milligrams. In a few months later, that was 3 milligrams.
Wow.
Well, it turns out he didn't do it because he liked me, you know, although I'm a very likable person.
Sure, I would say so.
But it turns out at that moment, see, at Livermore, when it was built, it was the marshland close to Berkeley.
Okay.
Because, you know, Berkeley was built a laboratory. Berkeley itself, campus, is very cramped, and they couldn't do that. And so somehow classify and build in a bomb, they want to be out of the way. Livermore was nowhere, nobody. Of course, by that time, when I come around in mid-1980s, all around Livermore become a suburb for the Bay Area, for the Silicon Valley.
Sure.
So houses, a very expensive house neighborhood are built around it.
Okay.
But there's one huge area you cannot tell, they cannot know what it is. Now everybody at the neighbor asks a question, what is that you're doing in there?
Uh-huh.
Well, we can't tell you, we'll have to shoot you.
Right.
Well, certainly doesn't satisfy the neighbors. They're very, very concerned, which caused the Livermore administration tremendous amount of problems.
Sure.
What do? If you tell them what we're doing, they're probably even more fearsome.
Right.
I think what they're doing is fusion research there.
Okay.
It's a laser fusion. Well,
what is now the natural ignition facility.
Yes, I'm reading between the lines
right.
here. Well, anyway, they cannot tell them about that. So what they have to tell them something to satisfy them. I happen to come along using aerogel, which Livermore is making for me.
Uh-huh.
But more important, I'm doing NASA space exploration, which is not classified.
That's right.
We're dying for people to know. So I was surprised. Within the first year Larry was working with me, they generated aerogel news events. I remember it's 152 events.
Wow.
Previously, there was zero. In other words, an event is a newspaper interview, it's a radio interview, it's a television interview. No, these news agency, unless it's something esoteric, you know, newsworthiness, they don't care, you know, unless someone get killed or something, you know. But Livermore cannot tell anybody anything.
Sure.
I think the glove on the zero gel.
And so
they generate 150 events the first year.
It's a public interest story.
The second year, there was 260 something events.
Wow.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, what it did, I think Livermore decided to spend their money to help me along. So the story could continue. I'm sure I wasn't the only one that reported this. Probably the other reason, but at least one of them that really caused the neighbors around us. Oh yeah, you're working with NASA, doing space exploration. But I don't know whether you want to keep this in there.
No, it's great.
but I think the work that we're doing for me is minuscule.
Right.
What they're really doing.
What they're really doing, but it generates a lot of public interest.
But it certainly it also diffuses a lot of a concern around it.
Definitely.
And I claim I have something to do to popularize it as an aerogel. It's because of that.
Well, I think that's probably accurate. so you've actually done a lot of chemical formulation work yourself then since.
Well, no, actually, when I started working there, they're doing that. Then I had an opportunity to do a flight project. I asked Livermore to make it for me. But you know, do a flight, and most people don't really realize it. See, JPL has learned throughout the years, in order for its mission to be successful, everything as carefully as possible you can.
Yeah.
Even if you as possible can, people do make errors.
Sure.
So every time there's an error, there's another layer of check and balances.
Right.
So in order to make aerogel for a flight, they immediately go to a flight rigor.
Okay.
You have people checking it, you have document it, you have paper, you have milestones, you know, everything else. So
actually, I empathize with this because I've flown missions on NASA's Vomit Comet, KC-135, and it's very much the same thing, but, you know, certainly scaled down quite a bit.
Yes. So as a result, when Livermore is a classified facility, number one, they couldn't afford so many outsiders, you know, come out and look at this. Because the aerogel development facility is for classified work. They're just doing this because...
For whatever.
For whatever, okay. So as a result, when we want to make some fly one, they couldn't keep the schedule because this is we hardly pay them anything to do this.
Sure.
And also they could not satisfy the quality QC controls
that's right.
So as a result, I have to make my own errors.
Okay.
So that I can make, with all these reviewers looking, people looking over my shoulder while I'm doing that, hey, why use your left hand this time? Why don't you use your left right hand? No, they're very meticulous. You got to come up with a schedule by certain dates, and you couldn't slip. If you slip, there's a major meeting, there's a discussion, why you fail, or can you do it all? Because if you slip one schedule, then they immediately say, maybe all the rest of the schedule, you couldn't keep it anyway.
I see.
So they will change the entire thing. So, so this rigor, I was learning that for sure Livermore would not be able to
sure.
come on. So I had to make it. then when I was starting making aerogel, then I could be a little more focused because I wasn't concerned of any other application. This is the only application.
Right.
I know exactly what I was looking for, I was trying to do.
And so you could perfect the formulation for your particular application, which was to catch comet dust.
Precisely.
So you became a chemist, whether or not you wanted to be one.
Well, I get it. You know, it's a challenge. You know, in life, you know, there are many, many challenges. And if you have a challenge, you have to find a way to resolve it. This happened to be more chemists and physics combined. Yeah. Well, you read up on it. You
sure.
learn about it. You talk to experts. You talk to people who know.
And that's a good, I think that's a good lesson for everyone to learn that it doesn't, you know, I as well, when I started making aerogels, I didn't really know how to make aerogels either. I hadn't done much chemistry at all, just other than what I had done in high school. And it was something that I was able to pick up with by reading about it and talking to people and making some mistakes, trying things out.
Well, I would like to go one step further. I think the person learns the best when there's a motivation why you learn.
A driving force.
A driving force. If you just go to class, you don't know why you want to learn it.
Yeah.
And you don't really care to learn that because, well, you're not going to learn very much.
Sure.
But then when you want to know, you will ask the questions that the teacher never thought of.
That's right.
But so that's very important. So I learned chemistry all over again, very narrowly.
Right.
Just
so you can, that's right. So so tell me a little bit about the formulation, the gradient density. That's a special technology.
Well, this one came a little bit later. Once I decided to use aerogel, then it's clearly I want to have a goal. That I want a variable, also, not just variable density. I want a smooth gradient variable density.
Oh, wow.
See, well, this is where you have to be very practical. At the time, when they started this proposal, I submitted in October of 1994. Before then, I was living on a shoestring budget. You know, I don't know where my next meal will come from. Uh-huh. and I do not have a great deal of funding to do a development of aerogel. And I'm as soon as I submit a proposal, I know exactly what to do. I have a whole bunch of questions, a whole bunch of goals. One of the goals, I would like to be able to make this variable density, but smooth gradient. But I realized in a flight project, you cannot do that. You can't say, I like to do that. No, you have to say exactly what you're going to do.
Right.
And describe what it is. So I had to give a schedule. I realized if once you give a schedule, if I don't meet it, I'm dead in the water.
Sure.
Okay. So they go to the lowest common denominator of that project, who would be a monolith aerogel. Because I have demonstrated I was able to make monolith aerogel, which is a single density. That would not be my ideal. If I single density, if it's too low density, I need too long a volume, which I don't have, at too high a density, it will break the particle.
Right.
Now, so I was being a little bit clever trying to do it. So I first did some development that to do a layer density.
Okay.
Okay. Well, it's actually...
How many layers?
It's a little more difficult than that. Because you cannot prove when you have two different layer aerogel that the boundary of what sticks it together.
Right.
You can't put some glue in there.
That's right.
You
know?
You have to do it so the two layer different layers that are really structurally bound to each other. Now, so what I did, I was able to make three or four layers, but it turns out what's practical in manufacturing, since I had to make a whole bunch of these cells, so there was three different layers. The top layer was 5 mg/cc.
Very low density.
Very low density. The middle one was 10, then the bottom one is 50.
Okay.
Well, so I had to be very clever. Although I wanted not the layer, because at the boundary layer from the two different density, it generates a shock. At the interface.
Okay.
So, well, I may have low density, but the shock probably does more damage
sure.
going through the density barrier. So, but anyway, I have to do something I know how to make. So I wrote down, I submitted all my schedule is layer density. I was able to make it, demonstrate it, and do a flight qualification on that. But in the meantime, I was working feverishly.
It's a secret.
Trying to find a way that I'd be able to make a smooth density So there'll be, I will cast it one time, so there'll be no boundary layers. Well, see, I have two boundary layers. The reason I don't want to have more layers, there'll be more boundary layers.
That's right.
That will cause more,
more
damage, more shock. So, well, fortunately, I'm very fortunate, again, by accident, because the story went like this. I know I can make smooth density aerogel use centrifugal force. Since I mix the aerogel, if I really using some kind of a force,
a centrifuge,
centrifuge or something like to push it inside. Although there's a whole bunch of issues because centrifuge, when it goes higher speed, like more than 5,000 RPM, you cannot use a breakable vessels.
Oh, I see.
You have to use metallic or plastic. But I don't want to use plastic because it will contaminate my aerogel because I'll get organic contamination. You know, and if I use metal, then what kind of metal I use, what kind of contamination issue, and it gets heavier. All these issues in that. So, well, anyway, I actually try. I find centrifuging my gel, actually I do create a density variation.
How significant?
Yeah, I could do as much as maybe factor one or two.
Okay. So go from 5 to 10, for example.
Yeah. Well, actually, before I was trying to solve the problem, I actually called an aerogel workshop. I invited the world's aerogel experts, several of them.
Uh-huh.
I figured I had a project, I had a little money.
Sure.
So I'll pay them. Johann Fricke from Germany.
He's sure, considered the Fricke group in Germany.
Yeah, he considered to be modern aerogel. Anyway, and I invite him to be here. And then I invite about six other experts, you know, Larry Rubish and Arlen Hunt
from Berkeley,
and Bruce Dunn from UCLA, and Jeff Brinker from
Naval Research Lab.
Jeff Brinker from University of Mexico, Sandia. I posed them with one question is, well, how do I make a variable density aerogel? Or even aerogel with density greater than factor of 5? At the end of a workshop, a whole day and all that, they said, probably the best you can do is maybe 10%.
10%.
The most is 20%. And you couldn't even control that 20%.
Uh-huh.
Because when you do cast the aerogel, there is some variation in the wall. And that's about a few percent. Maybe you can stretch a little bit, hot and cold.
Sure.
They imagine me 20%. They said, that's not good enough. 10-20% doesn't help very much.
Right.
You know, I want factors of 5 or 10.
5 or 10.
So after the workshop, it turns out, I still had the problem in my hand. It turns out, although I was not too worried, at least I have a layer one. Okay, at least I get the density. I figure from 5 milligrams to 50 milligrams, 10 to 1, it helps a little bit. Well, it just so happened. In order for me to use a lot of test equipment, and since we're with Caltech, and Caltech has a lot of test equipment.
Sure.
I couldn't afford to buy all that. For example, an ICP.
What's an ICP?
ICPM. It's a. What does that stand for? Oh.
What does it do?
It's a method to analyze the chemical composition of solids. What you do, you take the solid material, dissolve it, and stream dilute it using ionization. And to be able to measure detect what kind of material, the quantity, so very sensitive material. And if I were to buy such an instrument, I don't have the time to learn how to use it.
That's right.
I don't mind that. Okay, so I used the Caltech facility. While I was doing that, one of my helper was using that, and to notice that they were also, it's in a biology lab. Those who happen to have the equipment, they happen to using sort of a some kind of virus research. They need a medium to grow this virus here, But the medium has to be variable density medium.
Oh, okay.
A sugar medium.
Okay.
They want higher density sugar and then it gets lower, lower, lower.
Okay.
For whatever reason, I don't know.
Okay.
They had a way to make a sugar solution that's variable density. Ah, when I heard that, hey. That's
very close to what you need to do.
Yeah. Well, of course, I don't know whether the aerogel will work at all.
Sure.
Yeah, it will not always work. But since by accident we learned this, hey, let's go try it. I duplicated their system, and sure enough, it worked.
Wow. And you're able to get a variation in how much?
Well, that was only a factor of one or two, but at least I have a method that I can go approach to do it.
Oh, so this is where the centrifuge came from.
No, the centrifuge came before that, but I realized in order for me to implement a centrifuge, the centrifuge has to be the size of a room.
Oh, I see. So this is instead of the centrifuge.
Yes.
So what were they doing?
Well, I don't know. They were doing some sugar growing, some viral research, you know. I came back, duplicated the system of work. Wow!
So what would the system entail? Like, how does it achieve variable density?
Well, actually, the idea is very, very simple. They were making a sugar solution, so they had the highest sugar content, lower. They had two solutions. One is lowest, one is highest.
Ah.
They just differentially pump that into a medium.
Okay.
Very carefully. Okay. So obviously, you would bottom, you pump the high density first, and then you pump the low density until it's all low density, so therefore they were able to do it.
Okay.
So I basically duplicated the system work. Okay.
But with aerogel precursors.
With liquid aerogel precursor. And I'm very, very happy, very lucky.
Right.
It's again accidents, two accidents now. I discovered the aerogel on somebody's windowsill, not because of my design. I came out with this method. Otherwise, if I did not come up with this method, I would have to build a centrifuge. I dreaded to do that.
Yeah.
Because with such a high mass, most centrifuges, with high speed centrifuges, are very small.
Right.
Tubes and all
it
that.
Fits on a tabletop.
Yeah, but I have to have, gallons of this stuff. I got to swing this awfully fast, greater than maybe 50 to 100,000 RPM.
Wow.
Well, this thing, if it breaks,
a lot of energy.
A lot of energy. So I just dreaded to do that.
Yeah.
So this method came up, I was elated.
Wow. So is that the method that you actually ended up using? And so the density gradient in the stardust cells is only about a factor of two then?
I don't know. It's about a factor of 8 or 10.
So how did you make the jump from about 1 to 2 to 8 to 10?
Well, using the same approach, you have two different. I have a 2 milligram or 5 milligram aerogel salt. Then I had 50 milligrams aerogel precursor. I just differentially pump.
And then, so just with a refinement of that technique that you found on accident, you were able to make the material you needed.
Yes.
Well, that's a fantastic story.
It's phenomenal.
And so actually, and that technology has been patented since then, is that correct?
Yeah.
That's right. So do you see an application for it beyond the Stardust mission?
Oh, yes.
For example?
Well, for example, many lenses, all the lenses you use, it has many other advantages. One disadvantage is that glass density tend to be the same.
Yeah.
You cannot make glass of a variable density.
Sure.
If you're able to do it, you could control the diffraction of the light. You could do corrections because most lenses at the edges have all kinds of
edge effects. Yeah.
But if you could change the density, you can really
compensate
it, make it a large lens, a large aperture, all of them without deformation.
So this technique could be perhaps extended to making variable density zero gels, which you use for a lens.
Yes, or there are many other applications. Well, it turns out, I'm sure making a sugar solution, this is known to the community already.
For a long time.
But just I didn't know.
Sure.
I didn't know it would work for arrows.
Right. Well, and no one did, actually.
Yeah. So once I discovered that method and demonstrated it does work, now I have a variable density. So, in fact, in my flight schedule, I was doing layer. I've already flight qualified the layer. But I always left a blank in there saying that I have an opportunity to do one more flight qualification.
Just in case.
Just in case. I come up with it. I may use that. I'm glad I did. I had a placeholder there. We did the fly plot. It was qualified. It was gone.
Well, that was a good bet to make.
So, no, I think it really significantly improved the science.
Yeah.
Because it's later on, I because of all kinds of restrictions, I only get 3 centimeters total length.
Okay.
That's all. Originally, I was going to get 8. For some reason, I end up only 3. Only 3 centimeters. If I only have monolith, I do even layer one, I'm very limited in what I can do.
Sure.
Now, with smooth variable density, I think I can achieve a great deal.
So let's talk about the results of the Stardust mission. The probe has since returned, and in fact, I believe they've been extracting parts for quite some time now.
Well, it actually landed on January 15th of 06, last year. And because the 16th is Martin Luther Day, so they moved from Utah, where it landed, the sample capsule, to Houston, where the laboratory will be integrated.
At Johnson on the Space Center.
Johnson Space Center, Houston, on the 17th. So on the 17th, it got there about noontime or so, and we opened up the sample canister about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I took the tray out, disassembled it, and without doing details for the first day, about 7 o'clock. So it was electrifying to see what it is. Because when I opened up, I didn't know what to expect. It could have no particles.
Nothing in it.
Yeah. Do you realize I'm going billions of miles away, you can't see. It's all by calculation. You're thinking, how do you know you even caught any particle? How do you know there'd be blank?
Yeah.
It would be very bad after 8 years. I delivered a year before, and it was 8 years later.
Nothing.
You can't guarantee it. I don't care how much planning, how smart we are, you can't plan that. Anyway, at that time beforehand, I told the scientists and all the co-eyes, if I can capture one particle that you can see with your naked eye, the naked eye probably see 20, 30, maybe 30, 40 microns in size particle with a track. You know, if I can see one of them, I think we've done something.
Sure.
Everybody agreed. If you have one large particle,
that's a success.
If you see, that's a success. We opened our saw. Probably there were 3 dozen.
Wow.
One of them is as big, the track. It's about 1.5 centimeter into there, half the cell.
Wow.
You can really see the track. And this is the particle down below there.
So Peter Su is showing me a picture, which is on the cover of Science, which is one of the most prominent journals in the science community, and of one of his cells and a track, which has a particle embedded in the end of it. So that's a pretty impressive accomplishment to get on the cover of Science.
Yes. Well, yeah, this is the second time Stardust, then during the encounter we got one. Yes, we're very happy. We want to be in Science because that's more U.S.-based, and nature is probably more
European. Sure, sure. So they've extracted particles now.
Yes, we have. We have recovered this far, probably, I don't know, at least a few months ago. At the end of a preliminary examination, which is August of last year, of 06, we have looked at about 70 particles.
Okay.
Which is about only a few percent of the total particles we have captured.
So there's a lot of particles that you can't see with the naked eye, but are still present.
Yeah. Oh, there are the particles you can see with naked eye, which we only analyzed maybe 3 or 4 of them.
Okay.
Majority of them are still yet to be distributed. Some of them are actually put away, wait for a decade or so before release. But there'll be new analysis techniques. There'll be new analysts.
Like a time capsule sent into the future.
No, we do know. We do know technology is improving every day. So if we consume all the particles, we are basically not leaving the possibility that newer instruments could see things we don't see now.
So what kinds of analysis have you done to determine the composition of the particles?
We have a group of, then we form, well, actually, this is the first time, and that's something we push. I'm very happy that we did that. We actually opened normal mission that the investigator, co-investigator, only does the preliminary examination. But we decided this is the time at Mission Combat. There are only 13 co-investigators on the mission. But we decided to open up doing analysis to throughout the whole world.
Oh, great.
The reason, there's several reasons we want to do it. Number one, we want many people to be involved so we could potentially same analysis and more than one or several analysts so we can collaborate the results. Because when you have such a few analysts, one person does that, and you're not sure.
Sure. People make mistakes.
Yes. Or
machines
whatever.
Don't work right.
Yeah. So the one, number two, we wanted the results to come out very rapidly. So the only way to do that to have
make
more.
Make it open source.
to have more analysts involved, so then each person can focus on a smaller area, then the results will come out quickly. I'm very proud. I'm the manager for the preliminary examination as well. There were 200 scientists throughout the whole world really involved. And I distributed a sample the second day after we opened up.
Well, what a great idea.
And it distributed. And we finished doing the distributed sample in August of that year. And by December, our papers, first set of papers published.
So what kinds of things have you found? What is the comet made of?
Well, that's I don't think we know the final results 20 years maybe from now.
Okay.
Because to analyze each particle, it takes several months or a year. So, you know, well, let me tell you a little bit of that. Now, before Stardust mission, it is believed the comet, there are modelers due to astronomy or Earth observations through spectroscopy and so on and so forth. We believe the comet is probably made of materials left over from other interstellar material at the formation of the solar system. And because these comets form at the edge of the solar system tend to be cold, the temperature is very cold.
Sure.
And tend to be perhaps more volatile, lower temperature formulated material. In fact, Mel Greenberg had a model of it. This is saying cometary is likely to be made of tenth of a micron or small things that are just clumped together.
Clumped together into a giant comet.
Due to water ice or some kind of other organic ice. So we expected the cometary material, all very fine grained.
Okay.
Material, basically. Then we analyzed it. We were just appalled. Well, we found one particle as large as 50 micron, one solid grain.
Oh.
So if it starts out a tenth of micron, the comet has no pressure, has no temperature to accrete it to a larger particle. So has to come from outside.
Oh, interesting.
If it comes from another star, stellar material, we don't believe interstellar dust could be as big as 50 micron.
Wow. So that really affects the science.
So all the model that we had before Stardust mission, how the solar systems will form, how does it propagate and all that, all now had to be re-examined. And there's nothing wrong with that. Because
that's good.
Before,
that's a great result.
Before you have new data, you got to have start based on what you have. So we learned that in fact, we found one grain, so-called CAI. It's a calcium aluminum inclusion,
okay.
Which is a short term for a very high temperature mineral. It probably is formed 1700 to even 2000 degrees C. We know the comets are very cold. Minus 200 some odd degrees C, there's no way it can form in there. So that has to come from someplace. Now, most likely it probably come from the central core. The sun is very hot, likely to have CAI type of material. In fact, we found that close to the sun, you have material very hot.
Very interesting.
So, which shows that there might be a considerable mixing, because in the beginning within the solar system, when it's formed, the solar nebula, there's not much mixing from the central core all the way to the edge, which is 100,000 AU, which is very, very far
very
away.
Far.
Well, it shows that it looks like either that CAI comes from the center of the Earth or from other stars elsewhere. So very interesting. So the model, what we thought we understand how the solar system formed, it will have a new input to cause modelers to rethink now.
Very cool.
Well, the other, there's a whole bunch of things we can talk about, but another something which I am personally, I had two questions I want to answer. That's why I, last 25 years, have been pushing for this mission, is that where does the water come from? Where does light come from? From comet, right?
Right.
Well, I was looking for the answer for that. I have not found water, obviously, in the sample.
Sure.
But after it's captured, it was 2 years before it comes back, and due to cost or other reasons, we do not have a hermetical seal of it. It was just basically open, breathe to the outside vacuum,
sure.
Which is 10 to minus, 14 torr, which is, we couldn't even generate such a low vacuum on Earth very
yeah.
easily. So you had 2 years for it to vaporize,
right.
You know. So potentially this hydrocarbons and things like that would have escaped.
Totally left.
Okay. If I capture a piece of ice, which there may be some circumstantial evidence, because I have some tracks, a pretty substantial track. So in order to make a track, it has to be something very solid to make a track.
Sure.
If it's it's gas, it's not going to make a track.
Sure.
So if it's liquid, it's not going to make a track. So to make a track, like what you see here,
sure.
It has to be something very solid. Now ice, at the time you have potentially, it's very solid. Well, anyway, but I see nothing in there. So there are not that many. There are some.
A few.
Yeah. Also, I don't believe that the comets is are independent grains of ice. The ice are mixed with dust and things like that. So there are circumstantial evidence. You know, there are potential. I have some tracks. I cannot find anything but the tracks.
Some clues.
So some clues. Okay. Something else is very puzzling to me, that we believe comets are a lot of water. If it's a lot of water, it should have a lot of hydrated minerals.
Sure.
Of various types. We found about 70 some of our particles.
Okay.
There are hardly two of them are alike, but none of them are hydrated minerals.
Fascinating.
Well, it had a lot of water. We should expect hydrogen minerals,
right.
But we haven't found some.
So does this imply there's...
there are two reasons. One conclusion is no water.
Okay.
Okay. Which is not possible. Because we've observed by Earth spectrographs, and there's no water in there. Okay. It could be that our high-speed capture process that caused a change. And 6 kilometers still six very
sure.
respectable speed. So we don't know yet. We're going to do some experiment trying to prove that point one way or the other.
Well, aren't aerogels known for absorbing water? Is it possible the aerogel dehydrated the minerals?
Well, yeah, it is. But the aerogel, but on the other hand, since I wanted this mission to have a volatiles capture instrument due to cost or the reason. We didn't have it.
I see.
And then that's why I wanted also a material that's a high surface area. But by chance, some of them are trapped within the
inches. Some of the
they may come back.
That's
okay.
A fifth property.
Yeah. Well, in fact, we've shown that that idea really worked.
Dr. Sue is opening the issue of Science Magazine now.
It shows one article. And here's... here's the two sets of tracks. This is the track. This is the track where it looks like. This is what it looks like.
Okay.
This, after we look at from a UV spectrometry, we can see they are organic trap in here.
Kind of creating a plume around the track,
it looks
like.
And yet, this track here, which is actually larger than this other track, there is none.
There's nothing around it.
So
it depends on the particle.
It has some particles are more organic rich than others.
Very interesting.
And we are in the process of trying to fully understand what it is yet. And we, we have some tentative conclusion, but we want to do a lot more to do it. So the aerogel high internal surface area, in a sense, that did serve a purpose, but we're still at that. So in other words, the two major questions is life come from a comet, or you say it's too early to tell.
Okay.
Whether water come from comets, that's also too early to tell.
What's your hunch?
The next mission, my hunch is, instead of the hunches, I would like to propose another mission.
Okay.
That in
Stardust 2?
Stardust 2. In fact, I will be able to preserve the ice so we can really answer the question.
Well, that sounds like a really cool idea. So is there anything that the people listening to this might be able to do to contribute? I've heard that there's an effort on the internet where people can sort through pictures and try to identify trash.
Well, that's Stardust at Home project. Well, I was being a little clever. Whenever you have a collector, you have only used one side. Well, you could think in the middle of a collection, you could flip. But if you flip, you use the back side, but the other side has become the back.
That's right.
So whatever you do, you can only use one side. The other side is totally not used.
Okay.
That's a shame, because it took me 7 years to do a 5-minute collection.
Right.
And I only used one side of that.
And talk about going to San Francisco to use a gun.
So what I thought to do is, one side I will collect cometary particles.
Okay.
The back side, I will have a different set of aerogel formulation that can optimize for interstellar dust.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the preliminary examination and what we have done is only on the cometary side.
Okay.
Which is half, which is 3 centimeters thick. Mm-hmm. The interstellar dust is only 1 centimeter thick.
Okay.
And the density ratio is even much lower.
Okay.
Because the interstellar dust, the average
much speed, lighter.
Much higher. Higher speed.
It's much higher.
Higher speed, and which is more destructive. So my goal there is 2 milligrams versus 20 milligrams.
Okay.
It's much thinner.
In 1 centimeter.
Yes, in 1 centimeter. Yes.
So you have a double-sided Stardust cluster on Stardust 2.
Yes.
Well, very cool. So when's Stardust 2 going to fly?
Well,
maybe it's premature.
Before it starts, the interstellar side, the Stardust at Home is an attempt that Andrew from Berkeley proposed, is that since the part there, we expect maybe 100 particles. Now, on the cometary side, we'll probably capture about 500, 600 particle thousands. Okay. On cometary, in the star side, considerable fewer, which is, if it is we capture, let's say 100 particles, that's one particle per cell, which is 2 centimeter by 4 centimeter surface area, only one particle, very, very small one, very hard to find.
Very difficult to find.
The idea started as a home is that we'll do the scanning images, make it available for the general public that who are interested in this, and search through these images to find where all the possible tracks.
Leverage all that extra bandwidth out there. There's a link available on the Stardust page of aerogel.org, which can take our listeners to the Stardust at Home page and where they can contribute to this mission as well.
Yeah.
So do you have anything you'd like to say in parting to our audience?
Well, I would say maybe I become an example of that if you had a dream and you want to be very persistent. And many people think, submitting 13 proposals for a flight project is too many. But then it worked. So if anything, if anybody in the audience who have an idea, however crazy it may sound, so long as you do your homework, make sure that the idea is sound, that it's worth doing, be persistent. A decade, maybe two, and maybe realize it. If you do not have the dream, if you do not persist to it, it won't. So I would say that if anything, I can be an example for someone. I started out not from the planetary science, not a chemist. I didn't know anything about aerogel. Yet, I turned out to made a major contribution on several of those areas.
Certainly. A man with a mission, Dr. Peter So, one of the re-inventors of aerogel.
For aerogel.org, I'm Steven Steiner, reminding you that aerogel's not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved. Thanks for listening.